the city of Grand Rapids, and that's where I live. We're going to do a couple of preliminary things first. First of all, the coffee is for the public, so if you need some coffee or cookies, feel free. We won't be embarrassed at all or think you're bad if you just go up and get some coffee if you need some coffee. We want to thank Carol and Dave. Is it Jadovic? Nick, is that correct? Did I pronounce it correctly? For the facility. This is a lovely facility. I went into the restaurant, and it's a great restaurant, a great menu. So anybody locally, come out here and eat. I appreciate that. Also, thanks to Bill Johnson. This is the first time that we're using the mobile equipment, and he really helped set up all these mics and so forth. So thank you, Bill, for volunteering that. I knew there was always a tech person in the crowd someplace or another to help us. But my grandkids aren't with me, so you served in their proposal in their behalf. I want to start the meeting by just a very, very quick introduction of the members, if they will tell their name, which district they are, and what town or area that they represent. So let's start way down at the end. I can't even see who's there. Oh, Tim, go ahead.
I'm from the district just north of here, which is 8 feet, which is north of three townships, so by Santa County, all of Kennedy County, and southern half of Pine County. I've got the city of Brandon and Stanfield, that's the area that I represent.
Just go right down the list.
Oh, I'm Ken Schumper. I'm a dairy farmer from the southeastern corner of the state, Houston and Fillmore County. Right across the river from La Crosse, Wisconsin, Mississippi River there. So you're welcome to come down and hunt deer and turkey anytime you'd like to.
I'm Mindy Greiling, and I represent Roseville, Lauderdale, and St. Anthony Village. And if you're ever at the Capitol and you know where Rice Street is that goes right between Sears and the Capitol, if you go north on that, about 10 or 15 minutes, you will come to the district that I represent.
I'm Sandra Erickson. I represent District 16A, which is west of here, all of Mille Lacs County, half of Morrison, half of Benton, and one township in Sherburne County, Baldwin, probably one of the fastest growing in the state. I do not serve on Ways and Means, so I'm here as an adjunct. I specialize mostly in education.
I am Erin Murphy, and I am a registered nurse, and I'm from 64A, which is in St. Paul.
Hi, I'm Representative Marcia Swales. I'm an AP English teacher. I represent Woodbury and Landfall. That's 9 miles from the Wisconsin border. It's a suburb of the Twin Cities.
I'm Matt Dean. I represent places in northern Washington County and like Stillwater and Matamida and Delwood, where I live, and I look forward to hearing from your testimony tonight. Thank you.
I'm Bill Hilty. I represent District 8A. Which is the northern and eastern parts of Pine County, almost all of Carlton County, a little bit of St. Louis County, from just north of Sandstone to Cloquet.
Good evening. I'm Carlos Fabiani-Rosa, and I'm from St. Paul. I've got the capital in my district. I have downtown St. Paul. I've got Boca Chica Restaurant on the west side, and I have the old Schmidt. It used to be the Schmidt Brewery down in West 7. Pleasure to be here tonight.
I'm Lyndon Carlson, and like to say I'm one of the junior members of the Minnesota House, and I represent Robbinsdale, Crystal, Golden Valley, and part of New Hope.
I'm Denny McNamara, and I represent the district just about 20 miles downriver from St. Paul. I live in Hastings. My district is in northern Dakota County and southern Washington County.
I'm Rob Eastland. This is my district that we're here with tonight, and I would like to welcome the Ways and Means Committee to my district and a little bit of District 17A hospitality. Beautiful facility. We've been here a number of times, and we really enjoy it. And I want to thank everybody for coming out. It's going to be a good opportunity to bring government a little bit closer to people. And tonight I have the opportunity of being able to go home 1 mile from this place.
That's not fair.
I'm Bob Gunther. I represent District 24A. I'm 12 miles from Iowa. I live in the center part of the state, right south of Mankato, Fairmont's the city I live in.
Well, hello. I'm Rick Olstein. I'm a senator from District 17, which is Chisago County, part of Anoka County, St. Francis, and then most of Isanti County in the city of Isanti. So I am so excited that the Ways and Means Committee took the roadshow here. Now, these guys are the important folks, because when you say Ways and Means, they're talking money. So it's important that, the interaction tonight.
I'm Phyllis Kahn. My district is 59B. That's in Minneapolis, right around the university.
Hi, I'm Kathy Breinert from Mankato. I represent the city of Mankato and the surrounding townships and a tiny little bit of lower north Mankato. And I just finished 11 years on the Mankato Public Schools School Board, so I'm very interested in the education testimony tonight.
Good evening. My name is Tony Sertich. I represent the district of northern Minnesota, Chisholm and Hibbing, all the way down towards Duluth. I'm the majority leader in the House of Representatives, and thank you all for coming out tonight and for your input into the legislative process.
Good evening. I'm Ann Lincheski. I represent Bloomington, and I thank you very much for hosting us tonight.
As you can see, we got a diverse group in the Ways and Means Committee, and we have some of the people that are not on the Ways and Means Committee, but we welcome their input as well and appreciate the opportunity for them to be with us as well. Tonight, our goal is to listen to you people. The Ways and Means Committee is a committee that will set what we call the targets. That means that we will set the spending priorities in the House of Representatives for education, for property tax relief, for health and human services, for state government, for you name it. Now the different committees will get some kind of what we call a target, that they can't spend more than what this committee gives them as their ability to spend. So we have the tax committee chair is here, we have the education committee chair, and other chairs that will be involved in that particular process. Tonight we want to be able to have you give us your ideas of the spending priorities. But to start out with some kind of a basis, and we always start with a governor's budget proposal. We always say in the House that the governor proposes and the legislature disposes of the budget. But that's where we start from, is that particular spot, and we make the changes to that. Before we start that process, I want to have a couple of other staff people introduced. Christine Murphy is the committee administrator. Jerry Boyce is the committee legislative assistant. Dan Kane is with DFL House Research. Republican House Research came into, I think. Filling in? Mark Hines is here for that. Now, did I miss any other staff people that are out in the audience? And then we have two other staff people that I'd like to have them introduce themselves.
Mr. Chairman, there's also Sandy Connolly from media.
Pardon?
Sandy Connolly from media.
I'm Kathy Novak, and I'm with the House Research Department.
And Sandy Connolly, I think, is here as well, with one of the staff members. And?
Bill Marks, House Fiscal Staff.
We're going to give it to Bill to give us a little bit of an overview of the governor's proposal. Do you have a handout? That's there. I think there should be enough copies for everybody. And we'll start with that, and then you can also look at that, and he can propose, and you can dispose of that if you want to. But we need to start with some basis, so we'll have Bill Marks, who is the nonpartisan chief fiscal analyst, give us kind of an overview. And if you can't hear, let us know, please.
Mr. Chair, members, the handout is basically a summary of the governor's budget recommendations. This is still in somewhat of a draft form as we're putting it together. The first eight pages are really an overview summary of the budget recommendations. The last four pages, I've added some specific recommendations from various areas. K-12 education is the first page, higher ed and workforce development, the first of the last four. Healthcare and human services, property tax aids and credits, tax law changes, and then grouped a number of others together. As some highlights in here, if you turn to page 2, is a chart that that lays out basically the base level budget and then the changes the governor's recommending. As a matter of definitions, the base level budget here is essentially if current law was carried forward into the next biennium, into fiscal 2008 and 2009 in this case, and there were no changes made in that law, the revenues that would come in, the spending that would occur. If you look at the second column of that table one on page two, you can see in the revenues area for fiscal 2008 and 2009, revenues were $33,518,000,000 under current law. The governor's recommendations amount to $143 million in decrease, so that revenues would be $33,375,000,000 under that. And then as the change columns there, that's $1,130,000,000 higher than in fiscal 2006-2007, the previous biennium, and that would be 3.5% increase over the previous biennium. Just a caution here, we'll look at annual numbers on in a couple pages, but these are biennial comparisons. They're the way the legislature does budgeting 2 years at a time. They're not the normal sort of comparisons that many people would use if you're looking at changes on an annual basis. These are 2 years compared to 2 years. The second grouping there, the expenditures and transfers, the base level budget for 2008-2009 would have spending of $32,496,000,000. The governor's recommendations are a $1,953,000,000 increase over the base, for a total of $34,449,000,000. And then going across, that's a $2,944,000,000 or 9.3% increase over the fiscal 2006-2007 biennium. I'll just mention the chart on page 3, the one labeled Table 2, presents an all-funds budget. The previous chart was the state's general fund only. The table on page 2 has similar information. It adds in all funds. In addition to the general fund, it'd be funds like the Health Care Access Fund, the Trunk Highway Fund, Game and Fish Fund, federal funds, and a variety of those other types of funds. Then on page 4, this is the same kind of information as was in the first table, but this is on an annual basis. And this table 3, I'll just highlight the expenditures numbers here as an example. If you look at the third grouping there, fiscal year 2008, under the expenditures, the base level for fiscal 2008 only, a single year, would have been $16,083,000,000. The governor's recommending $865 million of increases for a total of $16,948,000,000, or a $986 million increase over the previous year, fiscal year 2007. It's a 6.2% increase over the previous year. And in 2009, a similar comparison there. The point here would be what's presented as a 9.3% increase on a biennial basis. If you look at it annually, 6.2% in the first year, 3.3% in the second year. On page 5, table 4, presents the information on the basis of the House Fiscal Committee structure. And some of these, this is broken down so it lines up with our committee structure. It's not necessarily, if you think about Health and Human Services, for example, that the programs that might typically be there are in three different committees in the House. So it's not necessarily what you would normally look at. But this is presenting on a committee-by-committee basis the same kind of information. The fiscal year 2006-2007, the biennium we're in, the appropriations for that year, base level for 2008-2009, governor's recommendations for 2008-2009, and then the final two columns. The first one is comparing the governor's recommendations for the fiscal 2008-2009 biennium to the previous biennium, to 2006-2007, and shows the percent increase. The second column, or the last column actually, presents governor's recommendations compared to the base, the current law base for the current for the 2008-2009 biennium, and shows the percentage changes there. Just one thing I want to mention in here in the education area, the second line on the chart, we've separated that one out because during the 2006-2007 biennium, there were a number of education shifts that were paid back, $600 million of education shifts that were paid back. And so that's why it looks kind of unusual there, because there would basically be no shift changes in the 2008-2009 biennium, and to add that into the education number makes a substantial difference in the percent change there. The other charts in here, the one on the next page presents the 2010-2011 implications, what we would commonly call the tails in the discussion. Table 6 on page 7 shows some revenue changes, which are relatively small in the overall picture here. And then Table 7 presents price of government information. This is revenue information that's looked at for state revenues, city and county and township revenues, and then school district revenues. And then, as I mentioned, the final four pages present information on various parts of the budget that I think I'll skip over unless there are questions on.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Probably the best way to proceed, then, is we've asked people to kind of sign up for the opportunity to testify. And I know what Bill gave you was a 5-minute or 10-minute synopsis of a very complicated budget. But our goal tonight isn't to dissect that particular budget, but to have you give an opportunity to tell us what your concerns are, what our spending priorities should be, just an opportunity for us to listen. If you have some specific questions, we will try our best to be able to answer them. If you have questions that you feel uncomfortable on testifying, feel free to write down it on a piece of paper and get it to the staff members that are around. If you get your address or your email, we'll try our best to answer those as well. So it's an opportunity for us to listen to your concerns. As we do that, particularly for the members at this table, I'm going to ask them to make sure their cell phones are turned off so we don't get interrupted, if you would, please. So the first panel, there were some people that wanted to testify, and they were kind of in the education field, so I wonder if they can come forward. They're listed on the agenda. Al Jones, Muffy Henye, is it? Carla Memkin, Sue Howard, Donna Hubbard, Bruce Novak, are they in the audience? And if you just feel free to come up and now keep in mind that we're just people as well, so don't be afraid of us. Feel free to give us your testimony. Now, we do want to be on the bus by 9 o'clock, so I will have to try to manage your time a little bit. If you get real long, I'll probably go something like this, and you can throw it short. And so, but feel free to start off. And whoever happens to be wants to go first, if you can identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate that. Yeah, and use the mic. So the mic probably doesn't help you out there very much, but it is being recorded, so I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. I'll go first.
And can you hear out there at all? Yeah, so you're going to have to really talk loud.
Okay.
And post it. Is the mic being amplified out there? Okay, it's working, so be close.
All right. My name is Carla Memkin. I'm a teacher in North Branch. I'm also the North Branch Education Association co-president. In the late 1990s, class size money was available for the sole purpose of reducing class size in grades K and 1. We had 17 to 18 students in our classrooms. We had approximately 18 kids in each reading class. We were able to read with each child daily. We were able to assess and provide interventions for struggling readers during the regular reading class. In the past 8 years, our class size has risen to 26 in K and 1. We now have 28 kids in reading. We have 28 because our Title I teachers were cut due to funding reductions, and our own teachers provide the Title I services. Therefore, we must take on more children in the regular reading classrooms in order for the title program to have fewer students. When 8 to 10 more students are added to a classroom, the educational climate changes. More time is needed to prepare materials and supplies. More time is needed to correct and to assess. Also, you had behavior issues due to lack of physical space and lack of individual attention. All of us are aware that we need to address social and behavioral and emotional issues as well as the academic needs of our students. This is not the way to do it. Research shows that in order to raise test scores, we must address not only the struggling students, but we must provide opportunities for our top students as well. Test scores change rapidly when our top students thrive. However, 3 years ago, our program for our advanced readers in grades K through 2 was cut due to funding reductions. In our school, we have a system for student referrals. This system, called the Student Assistance Team, is in place to help teachers assess and problem solve when a student in their class is exhibiting social, emotional, or academic difficulties. Our school psychologist reports that 5 years ago, the average number of SAT referrals from a regular first grade classroom was 1. Today, the number has risen to 4 per classroom. This could be a result of many different situations. Our society has changed. We have families working many hours to make ends meet and kids exposed to violence and poverty and a host of other problems. On top of that, we had 8 to 10 more students and we have our 4-time increase in children with needs. During the past few years, our support staff of psychologists, counselors, and social workers has been cut in half. Our nursing assistants for the young children providing hearing and vision screening does not exist. How can we help kids learn? We have half our budget for supplies from $60 per pupil to $30 per pupil. We have lost half of our support staff, and we've lost half of the learning as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Carla. And then next, whoever wants to go. And if you'd identify yourself for the team.
Certainly. My name is Al Jones. I teach fifth grade in North Branch. I've been there since 1979. Some of the problem areas that I would like to identify for you, most importantly, I believe, is money for class size reduction, particularly in the primary grades. And along with that, we need money for early childhood education. We need to get help to at-risk students before they reach the end of third grade. Research shows clearly that students who are not at grade level in reading by the end of third grade have a very small likelihood of ever reaching grade level. So it's really critical that we get money for class size reduction and to support early childhood education. I'm also a firm believer in a longer school year. We have, I believe, the shortest school year of any industrialized nation, and our kids are falling behind, and we need more time with those students. I don't think it'll come for free. We're not going to work for free, but we need to fund a longer school year. And I would advocate a school year 200 days or more, and right now we're at about 185 roughly in North Branch. And finally, in my experience, one of the finest programs that we've had in North Branch was an after-school program for at-risk students. We had tremendous participation in that program. Students stayed after school. They were given individualized instruction. They were given social skills instruction, a treat. They played a game, and they were bused home. We called it Targeted Services in North Branch. It was funded by a grant. And in my experience, that program was extremely successful in working with small groups of at-risk students, and I believe that we need targeted funds for a program like that. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Next. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Jan Kozlowski. I teach Spanish at North Branch High School. Doing more with less.
Jan, can I interrupt you a second? Would you spell your last name?
I would be happy to. Kozlovsky.
Just like it sounds.
Just like it sounds.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Okay. Doing more with less has been the charge to our schools for many years now. The residents of property-poor districts like North Branch face an unfair burden when asked to pass a levy referendum to support our schools. You know, we are number one. We are the lowest per pupil expenditure in the state. At the same time, we were the fastest growing city in Minnesota in the 2000 census. The unfunded mandates continue at the national and state level. Our school population has been growing, but where we haven't been cutting, we struggle to teach more students with the same number of adults year after year. We have the same number of music and art teachers in our high school that we did when our school was half as big. And we actually have fewer art teachers in our district than we did 30 years ago. We don't have any world language classes in the middle school, though we used to have French and German and Spanish. Our classes are too big. More than 30 students in world language classes. 30 students in labs in science, where the labs were built for smaller classes. And the recommendation from a national science organization is a maximum of 24. 31 students at 14 workstations in furniture building class. 25 freshmen at 14 workstations in the introduction to tech ed classes. 90 students apply for 18 stations in the only small engines class. 21 students at 13 stations in welding class. 20 students at 10 workstations in machining. Funding targeted at vocational education was eliminated 6 years ago. Our teachers have more supervisory roles and advisory roles, taking time away from preparing lessons and working with students. At the same time, expectations for individual attention and contact with parents are growing fast. We lack the materials for special ed and the resources for students who aren't special ed but need more help. We have more requirements and no more funding. More and more testing is required, and this testing impacts the whole school. Testing in the computer lab means that that's not available for other students that day. Testing closes our media center to other classes 9 days each school year. On a typical day, 600 to 800 students would use the media center. We have to hire additional staff on testing days to monitor all the testing rooms and the regular rooms. Some of the higher expectations that we hear have questionable logic. Students identified as special education need to be at grade level with their peers. Students at alternative learning sites for a myriad of problems are expected to perform as if they didn't have those problems. And now all students are going to be expected to complete a year of college before they leave high school. Is that realistic? Is that necessary? And will our students be better for it? At the same time, we do offer concurrent enrollment classes in math, English, psychology, and Spanish through Cambridge Community College and the University of Minnesota. But there is no state aid that funds these programs, while other funds do support advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs. But why not concurrent enrollment? Like many schools in Minnesota, we're short on counselors, with each counselor responsible for 400 students, and the chemical dependency counselor was eliminated. We offer the skeleton of the extracurricular programs that were available to students when I started in North Branch. As advisor to the National Honor Society, I noted this year that many applications showed students who weren't very involved in student activities. Of course, this is because there aren't many activities left. We don't have a business club or a vocational club or FHA or a drama club or a language club or Students Against Driving Drunk or a marching band. Each year, there are fewer opportunities to belong to something, to learn leadership and cooperative skills through student organizations. We are a staff of incredibly dedicated, hardworking, and competent professionals, but we're not miracle workers. Our students deserve much more than we are able to provide for them. Students in North Branch deserve the same educational opportunities that other students in our state already have. They deserve much more than we can currently offer them. We need a big fix in educational funding to offer equal opportunities to all our students. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jen. And the next is...
Good evening. I thought we'd just keep the teacher flow going.
Okay.
My name is Susan Howard, and I teach fourth grade in North Branch Sunrise River School. And I would really just like to speak personally to you. I'm really concerned just about the lack of resources in the public schools. In the past few years, I've witnessed a decline in services for our students.
You can hold it closer.
At fourth grade, we have no more gifted and talented services. We have no more Title I services. Presently, I have 29 students in my classroom. I have one who leaves for special ed reading and math, and I have 28 students that remain with reading levels that vary from 8th grade to probably 1st grade. And I, as the teacher, am called to meet these needs. This is called differentiation. We affectionately call it more work and an impossibility for us. It's more printing. It's more prep. Sitting here at this table is one of my parents, and she's one of my volunteers. She's also a school board member. She comes in my classroom once a week. I have volunteers. If I didn't have them this year, I have one child who would be floundering. My volunteers sit at a table in the back of my room and do second grade materials with one of my students because that's the level she's at. We have no paraprofessionals for support, student support, or paperwork support. My volunteers, I don't like to use them for paperwork because they're priceless. It's time that they can work with my students. And that's my major concern. We need more help in our classrooms. We need more direct services for our students. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Sue. And?
Good evening. My name is Karen Saltis, and I'm a parent of two students in the North Branch school system.
I'm going to interrupt you a little bit, Karen. Do you have your spelling of your last name?
S is in Sam, A-L-T-I-S is in Sam. And I have copies here, too, I can give
okay,
you.
Okay, thank you.
A kindergartner and a fifth grader. Currently, I am also serving on the North Branch School Board, but I am here tonight to give my personal experience and not one as a board member. 5 years ago, my son entered kindergarten in North Branch. His class size was 18. This past fall, my daughter entered kindergarten, and she currently has 24 students in her class. If you do the math, that is a very dramatic 33% increase in class size. I know our district has been doing its best to keep class sizes as low as possible, but without an operating levy and lack of adequate funding from the state for our services, this has not happened. I personally have also seen programs that my son participated in be eliminated during the budget reduction process of the past few years. In first grade, my son was in the Gifted and Talented Education GATE program for reading. This program was eliminated a couple years ago when our district was struggling with a lack of funding. Although the district has done an excellent job coming up with new ideas to group similar level reading and math students together, I know that the time is now for additional funding. Our district has become very creative in arriving at new ways to deal with large class sizes, but I worry that these new ideas just aren't enough for our students or our teachers. In my professional career, I have been involved with budgeting in a large metro county for nearly 18 years, so I truly understand the difficulties people in positions of power have balancing the needs of everyone. However, I feel our students are a very wise investment. These children are our future, and we deserve to give them the best public education possible. Thank you for listening to my comments tonight. Feel free to call me at either my daytime or evening phone number if you wish to talk to me further. Thanks for your time. And I have a copy.
Thank you.
I'll finish up North Branch. My name is Donna Hubbard, and I also am on the North Branch School Board. But I come to you as a parent that has three children in our school district, a first grader, a fourth grader, and a fifth grader. I'm very concerned about the class sizes in our school district. When my son entered kindergarten 5 years ago, there were 17 children in his class. Now there are 28 to 29 students in second grade to fifth grade classes on an average. On an average, there are 30 students in fourth grade classes, and my first grader experiences 25 students in her first grade class. We have no GATE program for children who excel. The Title I is available only in K-1 through 2. Nothing is available for those children that need help in grades 3, 4, and 5. Chemical health has been affected. My first grader has no art. We offer no art in kindergarten, first, and second in North Branch because we have no money. First and second grade are split with their reading abilities. If you do not qualify for Title I, your children will be put into a reading group
But if that child excels and reads at a fifth or a sixth grade level in first grade, she remains in the advanced reading class for first grade and is not challenged. For FIAD, grades 3, 4, and 5 experience FIAD once in 5 days. In grades 2, they receive FIAD 2 out of 5 days. In grades 1, they receive FIAD 2 out of 6 days. Our FIAD teacher in the primary school sees 1,300 students in a 6-day period. One teacher. There are no field trips to speak of in our elementary levels at our school district. We have no new speakers. We can't even have Bruce the Bug Guy talk about bugs and centipedes and tarantulas in our school district because we have no money. Consumable products. Teachers are asking in January for reams of paper, Kleenexes, paper towels, baggies, paper plates, because we have no money for supplies in our school district. We have no transitional reading, as Ms. Howard mentioned, in fourth grade. And I am one of her volunteers, and I see how children struggle that read at a first and a second grade level, that don't know how to read a clock, a face clock, does not know how to tell time in fourth grade. That absolutely breaks my heart as a parent to see that going on in the United States of America. Volunteers are used in first grade for timed testing on reading. I can't even tell you as a parent how many countless hours I have spent in North Branch School District helping the children try to succeed in our school district. We have not enough volunteers in our school district to help out those struggling children, and Lord knows we have no money for paras to help those children. Volunteers help children that are at least 2 and 3 years behind their should-be academic levels. In the example I have given on my written copy, which I do have for you, are being able to read a face clock in fourth grade versus a digital clock. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. You'd identify yourself, please.
Bruce Novak, superintendent of the Cambridge Isani Schools. And I'd just like to start off by thanking all of you for being here this evening and taking the time to listen to the concerns that our communities have. I do not envy you, I guess, in the sense that, yes, you have a large amount of money to figure out how to spend, but when everybody starts pulling at your coat string, so to speak, or for a piece of that money, it doesn't get to be a very easy task. And I appreciate that because the same thing happens in our school districts. And you heard much of the testimony here this evening already. I would just share this with you. We have great schools, and we have great teachers and staff working in our schools who are doing a great job in the state of Minnesota. And that job is to prepare every one of our children to perpetuate our culture, the beliefs of our great country, so that every one of the children come out into our society being productive citizens in our communities, in our state, and certainly across our country and in their global world. I would also add that we take every child into our buildings without exception. My frustration and my fear is that we are spending a disproportionate amount of money for some of our students who may never, ever be able to pass the standards tests that are being expected of our teachers to get children to qualify for. STEM, great initiative. I support it. I believe in it. But I think when you start looking in the early grades, we have a hard time buying the licenses to keep our technology labs and softwares up to speed. We just don't have the $7,000 for one school site license to operate the software programs. So I think it's a great initiative, but the dollars that we invest go to the, and I don't want this to sound Like, we don't care about children who are struggling, but special needs students is the best way for me to say that. We spend a lot of money on special needs children who may never be able to pass a standardized test or any level of standardized test. What then happens to our high-level academic achievers, those who could be our next engineers and physicists and nuclear scientists? We leave them to survive on their own, and I think that's a real tragedy that I would hope that you would recognize. Another concern that I have, just looking at our school district, you know, 2% and 2% is what we're hearing. Fuel costs have gone up more than 2% in the last several years. Textbook costs have gone up more than 2%. And yet that's what we're expected to make things work in our schools. I had a call today from a teacher, algebra class, needing 25 algebra books because the duct tape is falling off, not holding the books together. And that's reality for us. I had to say, no, we can't order 25 books at $70 a book because we don't have it in our capital budget. That budget is finished. It's done. So how do you explain that to parents when not only they bring the book home and the duct tape is falling off, but they aren't able to bring books home? I think those are some real issues for us. I would ask you to think about this. Please do not just put one-time monies out to school districts to education. One-time money does not help us, because then the next time around we have to go back to our local community residents to try to somehow garner the monies that were there one time. And it's really a disservice, I think, to all of the educational systems. So either put it on the formula or be honest and realistic about not putting it out there at all. I think that would be the plea that I have for you this evening. The other thing I want to share with you, and you've heard it pretty eloquently up here this evening, we are not social hospitals, and yet oftentimes I feel that's the position we are in. We need to bring children in, have daycare for them early in the morning, daycare late into the afternoon and evenings. We provide them breakfast. We have to teach them social skills, how to say please and thank you, just a lot of things. And when I look across Cambridge Isani District, one of our greatest needs are having groups for children of divorced families or single-parent families or military families, and on the groups go. And yet we have had to pull the social workers and counselors out of our schools. We have some schools without any social service programs today, and those children still have the needs. How do we provide that for them? I had one other thought here, and I just lost it.
It's called Alzheimer's disease. I have it all the time.
Thanks a lot. I'm 29, right? A long time ago. Well, anyway, I just appreciate you being here this evening, and I really do empathize with the task we have before you, but please listen to everybody here, because I think we have some concern that you certainly can help to start to address. Thanks a lot.
Okay, I'm going to have to be a little bit of a tough guy and say we're kind of running out of a little bit of time, but I don't want to cut anybody's off as well. So if you got something to say, can you say it quickly, okay?
Can you hear me? Is it on?
Yep. So you can identify your name for the tape.
I'm Audrey Clough. I am a administrator at Cambridge Isani High School. I've been in public education for the last 31 years. And all at Cambridge, so I've been fortunate. I've spent 23 years in the classroom and 8 years as an administrator. And I felt in the first 23 years, I think public funding was really pretty good. We had the Minnesota Miracle, and I think we had Governor Carlson. And for me to say I thought Governor Carlson was great, it's like I've come a long ways. But I think he was for education. He did believe in education, and he supported education. We have been growing. We've had a budget crisis in our school for the last 8 years. At first it was 10% of supplies, 10% of this, and 10% of the last. And we never got back up to that 10%. In the last 8 years, we've had about $3.5 million cut at the high school. That's significant for a school, for our staff. And the only place now that we've been doing is with cuts in teachers. Before we did cut the books, we cut this, we cut that, but now we're cutting teachers. When teachers are retiring, we're not having them come back, or we're not hiring. And that's increased our class size over 5. I was in a class the other day evaluating I felt so sorry that there was 33 kids in that class. And you asked us to provide innovative things, innovative techniques and teaching, and we can't even move in the classroom. And I felt really, I mean, he was trying to do a game, and he was trying to, you know, because I was in there observing, and he wanted to do the special thing. And I felt sorry for him because he had a hard time walking in between and trying to get to the kids and help them out. We've had cut, and our prior principal did an excellent job in maintaining our programs. We didn't have major cuts in programs. But now this year, we've lost career planning. Next year, we're going to lose the apprenticeship program. All of our classes are adding 5 to 8 kids more in a classroom, and that is making a significant impact. You keep asking us to, you want individual IEPs for students. You want technical training. Well, I can tell you right now, technical training is expensive. We have one of the best vocational programs, I think, in the state of Minnesota. But, you know, you can only have 20 to 24 kids in that class, because it's a safety hazard. And I've been a prior vocational teacher, so I know that. I've been in charge of special ed for the last 3 years, and I've had to cut a special ed teacher. Well, that's increased. You think, well, our caseloads were 15 to 16. They're now 16 to 22. You might not think that's much, 5 students on a caseload, but you walk in their shoes, you do their casework and their paperwork, it's immense. And we've also cut paras in the classroom. And when you cut teachers and you cut paras, special ed students do fall through the cracks. And I think they are valuable, and we do owe them some of our time. The last thing I'll talk about is administratively. When I first started in administration 8 years ago here, we had 2 principals, a head principal, and then we had a dean of students, we had 3 counselors. And we had about 1,400 students. 8 years later, we have 1,600, ebb and flow, 1,600. We're down to 2 assistant principals, 1 principal, 2 counselors. We say student connection is important. I have to connect with 800 students. When I was a dean, I did connect with 400. I could do it. It was doable, but I can't do it with 800. And, you know, kids come with a lot more baggage than we did. Can you believe it? You know, us old fogies here. But they need us, and that connection is probably the most important thing we can do for them. And we can't do that. And the last thing, don't get me wrong, I love my job. To me, it has never been a job, but an incredible journey. I have met wonderful parents, teachers, and students. I am proud of what I have accomplished over the years. But you see, I want to do more. We need to do more. Our students are faced with many obstacles, much greater than we had. You are asking us to do so much, but yet you have offered us so little. Quit bashing our system. Ask us how you can help. Yes, we can do better, and so can you. Step up to the plate and work with us, not against us, because we're all in this together. You can do this by providing more than a 2% funding increase. Our students, our parents, our staff, and our state deserve your support of funding public education to what it needs to be, and I thank you for your time.
Audrey, I need to interrupt a second. Can you spell your last name?
C-L-O-U-G-H. Or my kids say C-L-U-F-F.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to testify? And again, we're kind of running out of time, but we'll turn it off. You can get... No, I need you to have it for the tape.
My name is Ruth Oliver. I teach at Fanny Middle School. I teach for science. And I just want to have a show of hands of anybody in this room who ever shot off a rocket at any time in their life. Show of hands. In the 1960s, think about this. This is a sad time, because in the 1960s, with the Sputnik that pushed on that drive to the moon, and all that innovation and technology and interest in science and technology. And now, we have kids, and we have budgets in our classroom where I can't even afford 1 rocket engine per kid in my 8th grade class, because I have 1/3 of one of my classes in special ed on IEP. Not just kids that are low and reading well below grade level, but kids who are at IEP. That means all testing, all work is modified individually for every child. And that class is a class of 33 children. These are middle school kids on your side, 22 of you. And you add another 3rd on top of that, that's a lot of little bodies, and some big bodies, in our classrooms. And we have these state-funded testing coming up in science. We are going to drop out, if testing goes well, 14 days of our curriculum to finish the testing in science. 14 days that we could be teaching that now we are going to have to disrupt the schedule of all eighth graders in all classes because everything's going to be turned around because we have to shift 30 kids through three sessions of 90 minutes to get through the state funding tested in science. That's only the science test. Now, to top that off, we have labs that are inadequate for the testing that was mandated by the legislators. I love the state standards. I've been trained by the University of Minnesota, by Bethel, by St. Thomas, and by the Science Museum to do science in the field, inquiry science that actually does stuff out in the field, takes kids to the North Shore and looks at volcanics, goes down fossil hunting along the river. We go out in other places along the North Shore and in Isani County. We've even flown over places in Isani County to look at the water issues here and study the creek and the river behind our school. But with all of this testing, we can't do that anymore. With class sizes the way they are, we can't continue. And our labs that we are expecting to do this testing on are inadequate for most school districts in this region. North Branch had a horrendous experience with test piloting this work on the test. Our school is coming up in May. Braham doesn't have any facilities for this testing. None whatsoever. We only have three labs in our district that are even moderately adequate, but that will drop out anything else that goes on to the month of May in those labs. If this kind of testing is required by you folks as representatives, we need to see the proof in the pudding for the work to get it done. We need the lab in every school building, not just in one building. We need labs that are adequate with the platforms that will work with the testing that you require in every building. We cannot do this if we don't have the facilities. It's like when I taught my first years of teaching in the Philippines, we had a chalkboard, we had benches, and each kid brought two pieces of chalk to the classroom. Now that's bare-bones teaching. But right now, every teacher is bringing in thousands of dollars, unreimbursed by tax credits, by any other options. They just put it out. And I'm not saying they have a lot to spend to start with anyway. That's a whole other issue. But we need, really, the infrastructure to do what you're asking us to do. We have excellent teachers. I think our teachers should really get a round of applause, and we should stop as a legislature and as a public from bashing our teachers. Because I think our education system is excellent, and we do fantastic things. Mr. Novak said it right. We take in every kid and we move them as far as we possibly can. And if we're going to push our kids into the new 100 years out, we need to have science, technology, math, and reading par excellence. We are dragging the world behind what we fund.
Okay. Love that.
Final word.
Okay.
Then, and I'll close.
Okay.
If you're asking us to do it, then you have to give us what is needed to complete the job. We have the will, we have the desire, and we have the expertise. But you have to fund the infrastructure to make it happen.
Thank you. We're going to try to do some shifting, but before you do that, I think on behalf of all of us up here, we appreciate very much you taking the time and giving testimony from your heart. I spent 38 years in the classroom, so I appreciate some of the struggles that you are doing as well. Any burning questions, or can we go on to the next panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just clarify, that was 38 years as a teacher, not as a student.
Well, they're probably both, maybe, huh?
Mr. Chair, we have a question from the audience.
It's not necessarily a question. For some reason, early childhood did not make it onto the panel of presenters, and I did respond last week saying that I'd be willing to come and speak with you.
Okay.
And I would like to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity, and I'm really impressed that everyone would come out on this nice cold night, and it is snowing. So thank you again. I'm Carrie Moberg. I'm the Early Childhood Program Coordinator in North Branch Schools, and I, too, have been an educator for many, many years, and I know that you have a very, very difficult job, and I'm glad I don't have your job. I'm happy to have mine. What I was asked to share a little bit about are the changes that have happened in early childhood in our school district. We have reduced the number of classes in ECFE. We have more families that are on the waiting list. I know you're aware that this is a universal access program, and we have a lot of success in helping families, but the families that are particularly in pain at this time, we used to do a collaborative program with Chisago County Public Health and visited all families with newborns. We're unable to continue that, and we have had a severe reduction in the services to our adolescent parents. And when I first started doing work with adolescent parents, we had 90% of the kids actually graduating from high school, which we all know is a huge economic investment. And currently we're not able to boast that statistic because we can't work with them as closely. My hope this legislative session is to see a commitment to parent and early education services. ECFE is based on the premise that parents are the primary educators of their children, and by supporting the parents and providing parent education and quality early childhood programming, children will be ready for their kindergarten through college experiences. Research does support that when parents are involved in their education process, the return on investment is significant and long-lasting. Most children in Minnesota attend public schools, and early childhood family education and school readiness are part of the continuum of the public school system, and we provide an awesome transition program, and I'm hoping that you will find a way to support that. I have a couple more comments, but I won't make them to keep it short, but I do want to say the brave words. I'm ready to pay more income tax to support education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, thank everybody in the panel for coming here. Let us then go on to the next panel, if we can. Appreciate that. Again, there is coffee available and cookies. We have Lori Lillian and Dennis Doran, is that correct? And Dennis, Lori. And again, I'm going to try my best. We were about 15 minutes over on that one. And, you know, these legislators have to at 8 o'clock meeting in the morning. We have to go back. So if you really want us to... be really responsive to your needs, we got to get some sleep too. So we welcome to the committee, and we want to give you an opportunity to give some testimony. If you can identify yourself for the team. Well, before you start that, we had one other person join us, and Margaret. I'm sorry, I meant to do that earlier.
I apologize for being late. I had to go see my own seventh grader's work at his elementary school. And pick up my fourth grader as well. I'm Margaret Anderson Kelleher. I represent District 60A, but probably more importantly for your purposes, I also am serving as Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Thank you for being here tonight on this cold and blustery night.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret.
My name is Dennis Doran, and... Chair and members of the committee, welcome to Isani County. I'm the president of Cambridge Medical Center. Cambridge Medical Center, just as a little background, is a regional health care facility that serves about 90,000 people, about five counties. We're an 86-bed facility. We provide acute care as well as behavioral health services, which means mental health and substance abuse for adults and adolescents. We're a little bit unique in that in the small community and small county, we serve 150,000 clinic patients, visits per year, 100,000 outpatient visits, 4,000 admissions. We have 900 employees. We're part of Alina Hospitals and Clinics, which is a large organization of about 23,000 employees, 5,000 physicians, and 2,500 volunteers. Just in Cambridge Medical Center itself, we have 65 physicians, 27 consulting physicians. We offer a wide spectrum of specialty services. With that background, I've come here to talk to you about health care costs, the rising cost of health care, something that I think is in everybody's mind, and I think more so every day. If you take a look at the dining room table and the discussions on co-insurance, deductibles, what insurance products should we get this year as the costs continue to rise? It's a serious issue. We do the same thing at the boardroom, at the board meetings, and I can delve a little bit deeper into that. Why is it costing more to run a hospital and a clinic? First of all, it's workforce. Believe it or not, physicians coming out of residency have a debt of $150,000 to $200,000. I will spend about $150,000 per year for the first physician, just cost, until they can get on their feet. We have shortages in radiology technologists, medical lab technicians, registered nurses, and the list goes on. Technology, great thing. We can do more now than we've ever done in the 38 years that I've been in healthcare. With the MRI, the CT scan, ultrasound, mammography, it's great. Great diagnostic tools. But it costs a lot of money. The uninsured and the underinsured. Just in Cambridge Medical Center itself, it's $3.3 million for charity care. When you talk about demographics, aging population, that's great. I'm glad to be older. But it also means that there's going to be more burden on healthcare in the very near future. And that is not just for the patient, it's also for the workforce. Chronic disease, you know, I'm all about freedom in this great country, but when our freedom of smoking injures other people, that's not right. And we're going tomorrow to the Capitol and lobby for support of a comprehensive statewide smoke-free workplace law. Chronic conditions such as cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and stroke are major killers in the U.S. and major sources of illness, hospitalizations, and health care costs. At least 80% of heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, and 40% of cancer could be avoided through a healthier diet, physical activity, and avoidance of tobacco use. The economics of the hospital are quite simple. Right here in Cambridge, 38% of our money comes from Medicare and Medicaid, of which pays 65% of our costs. So what happens? We put it on the third-party payers, the commercial insurers, which raises our premiums and the cost of health care for you and I. We are approaching a perfect storm. We have an aging population, which is good news. We have an aging workforce. We have declining reimbursement and the increasing number of uninsured and underinsured patients in Minnesota. We as healthcare leaders must join together with you to develop ways to improve the system. The time is now for healthcare reform. The time now is for preventive care. The time now is to encourage physical activity and to pay for preventive care. We could talk all night about the details of a better system. But before we wrap up, I want to share a couple thoughts with you, a few statistics. We know from the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota report, Unfinished Business, a discussion paper on the need for universal health coverage in Minnesota, released in 2006, that uninsured adults are 3 to 4 times more likely to forego preventive care. The same report noted that uninsured patients who need hospitalization are more likely to be in worse condition than insured patients. And 49% of uninsured adults with chronic disease forego medical treatment due to cost. Children are much the same. The report shows that uninsured children are 4 times more likely to go to the emergency room than insured children and are twice as likely to forego well child checkups. These statistics alone, and there are many more, make a compelling case for increased insurance coverage and access. Insured patients seek preventive care and services earlier. Receive the right care in the right setting and work closer with providers to manage chronic conditions. In the end, insured patients are healthier and cost the system less. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you tonight. Cambridge Medical Center, a community asset, is here to work with you as well as Alina Hospitals and Clinics to have a better system and to avoid what I see as a dismal future with the aging population, aging workforce, and the increased uninsured and underinsured. Thank you.
Thank you. Billy? You can identify yourself with the tape.
I'm Lori Lillian. And I'm...
You need to get this close to the mic.
I'm Lori Lillian.
Okay, there you go. Thank you.
Thank you. And I am chairperson of the Region 7E Initiative on Adult Mental Health and also on Children's. We cover Pine, Mille Lacs, Chisago, Kennebec, Isani. And what we're doing is working with the counties to try and get health care programs up and running, specifically the mental health programs. So one of my jobs actually is to help consumers find and keep the mental health programs. Right now, I don't know how many of you are aware of it, but we had a regional treatment center in Braham, Minnesota that has closed. It covered this region. It is not now available to us. We're having to send people to northern Minnesota if they will take them. We've sent somebody now to Fargo. Thank you. The Dakotas, they took them. And our problem is sending people wherever we can find a place because technically we don't have a place right now to send them. The regional treatment center is now closed. We're one of the only one regions in the state of Minnesota that does not have one. It does make our job a little bit difficult. What I'm asking is if you could keep us in mind when you plan on the funding for the health care for adults and the children. I go to different conferences, and I have talked to different presenters. And we've discussed the possibility if you can reach a child when they're young enough, it might actually stop or slow down the chain of mental illness to the point where the hospitalizations are kicking in more constantly, more frequently. We can have medication. We can find the problem, deal with it, and start working when they're young rather than to find out the problem later and have to deal with it as an adult. Services which I speak are funded through programs under medical assistance, Minnesota Care, general assistance, medical care. For example, some of the programs are but not limited to outpatient care, day treatment programs, something called DBT treatment, assisted living skills. If we can teach someone to take care and live on their own, it's best to do so they do not remain on the dole, so to speak. We now have people back to work. And a person I had talked to, call him Joe, said the only thing he wanted to be is a taxpayer. Oh, I'm sorry. It got me all choked up. But that's all he wanted to do. So we found a job. We're able to work with the Social Security system. Minnesota was one of the only two states in the United States that won a federal block grant for a pilot program. We put people on Social Security disability and people on something called SSI back to work. Us, of course, Vermont, you know, they get everything. Okay, it worked. Now they're working it across the United States. And now we're taking the money that we would have spent, and now we're paying taxes, we're buying into medications, we are now paying into health care programs, we're helping put roofs over our heads. We don't use as much as the, I think it's called EBT with the food cards. And we're actually putting back into the programs that we have borrowed from in the past. All we are asking is for a chance to be able to continue to do that. We've also found out what we actually believe that will happen if we don't fund these programs, and we're finding out these outcomes are happening. Children, you know, I'm almost sitting on the wrong group because I'm going to discuss the kids right now. The children are dropping out of school. We know that the teen suicide rates will increase. Hopelessness, why go any further? And we're discovering foster care costs will increase due to out-of-home placements. You'll have to pay more. Kids can't stay where they're at. We have to move them out of one situation and put them into another. The loss of jobs. The loss of being able to pay for the home, the apartments, the vehicles. The homelessness, we will figure, will start to kick in again and start to rise because the statistics are every third person out of four right now who is homeless on the street has one type of mental illness or the other, whether it's manic depression, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder. Oh boy, I could go on. We're keeping it short. And so we also have discovered, too, besides the mental illness, there are chemical dependency problems. One of the programs that we have specifically in this region, I'm really proud of representing. It's Safe Sobriety. And what it does is it's a crossover program. What it's done is it works with people with chronic mental illness and chemical dependency. It works. It's a 12-step program, very unique, and they asked me if I could just kind of let their name be known again. They just won, last year they were given a grant by the state of Minnesota, and we have used it and used it well. It's over the age of 18 and above, whether you are a person who has a chemical dependency problem, whether you're a friend, whether you're a family member, or somebody that's concerned, we'll take you. There's no charge. It's run on this 12-step program. And the thing is, people like it so well. We started with one program, and now we have 8 and would like to have 12. But, you know, the money, yeah. But we're doing what we can with it, and we've proven that we work. And I'm just asking you to please keep us in mind, because if we can keep people self-sufficient and getting more people self-sufficient out there, we proved we could do it. And I just want to say, I don't want to give up on somebody who's really going to try. And they proved it can work. And all I want to say is, please continue to help us to help ourselves.
Thank you very much. Just one quick question from Mr. Duran. What is your level of uncompensated care in your facility? Do you know?
Uncompensated care runs about a little over $5 million.
$5 million.
$3.3 million in charity care, another $2 million in bad debt, which means it's uncollectible.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow up, Mr. Rand, if I can ask, can you give the history of that? Like, what was it, say, 5 years ago, or what was it 10 years ago?
Good question.
I wish I could answer that question. I would be guessing. It's obviously increased, but how much, I cannot tell you right now.
Okay. Could I just ask you if you could forward that to the chair and he could distribute it to us? Just for instance, if it was $5 million today, I'd be curious to know what it was 5 and 10 years ago for your facility.
I can do that.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Okay, any other questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much for your good testimony. Okay, we appreciate that. And it's one of the issues that we're going to be obviously having to address in the legislature. The next panel is some local government officials, and if they can come up. Don't know exactly all of them. I think George and Sue and Marlis and John are others that want to come up. And it's 8:45. We'll again, I ask you to try not to repeat. But and if there's any other regular citizens that want to come up and join this group, we can sure do that as well. And welcome to the committee. And again, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, and I'd like to welcome all of you here today. I'm going to keep it real short and be a very good host so my counterparts here can speak to it. One thing I ask for is consistency. You know, there's been a lot of debate and discussion on LGA money and some statements being made about tying special conditions to some of the LGA in the absence of a few cities and a few specific circumstances. But once those programs start, it continues and goes down and down and down. The city of Isanti, LGA has made up 16% to 17% of our budget over the last 3 years. And we've been very consistent in keeping it in that level so that we have a consistent amount of expenditures and a consistent amount of revenue sources. And I would just ask that we keep that level keep consistent with it. If you do changes, as were done a few years ago, make them a time-delayed change. Do not say, okay, we're going to make this change this year. It's going to affect your budget this year. Cities are on a yearly financial calendar. We're not on a fiscal calendar. We don't follow the same pattern as the state, so that has a detrimental impact upon our budgeting. A couple other issues that I'll work on my two legislators who are talking to each other over there. Development impact fees and some timing issues with some of the timing requirements that the state puts on cities to have certain reports, and that causes a lot of extra work. But I'll talk with them about that, and hopefully you'll all answer some of those questions. And with that, I'll pass it on.
Thank you, Mayor. Okay. Again, if you can identify yourself for the tape.
Sue Larson. I'm a city council person for the city of Isani. And just to reiterate some of the things that Mayor George said, that it's just basically levy limits. We need to have a fair understanding on how that's going. It has to be consistent. LGA has to be consistent. Back when LGA was cut, that was detrimental to the city. It was really hard to try to figure out where we're going to make these cuts and how were we going to survive. And thankfully, we did survive. But looking at the economy now, looking at our TIF programs, tax abatement, business development, we need to have the tools to work with as we are growing cities and our relation from the metro up to here. It isn't that far. It's getting shorter every day. So those tools are vitally important to us. And at the same time, looking at how can we keep taxes in check? How can we, when our county commissioners are struggling with their budgets, you know, that's affecting our citizens' property taxes also. And what we do as a city, that becomes another burden on our taxpayers. And the other issue that I really want to, and I know it's not health, education, or property tax, but transportation. Anytime you get a chance to support transportation, whether it's our highways or whether it's rail opportunities, please take the opportunity to educate yourself in both areas so that you can realize that not only the community of Isani and Cambridge need transportation dollars, but the whole state of Minnesota really needs to look at our roadways and our railways and see how we can improve the economy for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I don't know if you want to pass it the other way and take turns going back and forth. Okay. Welcome to the committee, if you can identify.
Thank you. Yourself. Thank you very much. My name is Marlis Palmer. I'm the mayor of the city of Cambridge. I do want to welcome the chair and the members of the Ways and Means Committee here this evening. I was going to just briefly tell you kind of where Cambridge is. I know that our representative and senator know.
I know, too.
Okay, we're not very far away, right in the middle of Isanti County.
I know you're a policeman, too.
You do.
No. he didn't stop me. I just waved at him.
So you really didn't have any issues?
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, we're quite proud of the force. They're very vigilant. Actually, I have two people with me this evening, and I guess what we would like to speak to you just briefly about is property taxes. Caroline Moe, who is our financial director for the city of Cambridge, is right here in the black. And John Schlegel, who is a council member, is in the striped shirt a little bit further up. John and I are also members of the Cambridge Economic Development Authority, and Caroline at this time is the executive director. We've really changed, I think, all of Isanti County. I know that Cambridge certainly has. In the year 2007, we will almost have doubled our population since 1998. This has been an extreme challenge for the city of Cambridge. And just talking about two things, providing new and maintaining the infrastructure that we have and offering really good services to our citizens. Part of the challenge is to keep the property taxes at a rate where the citizens are not overly burdened and we can still provide what they want and what they need, and mostly what they need. Caroline will speak more to you about that. Actually, last November, Governor Pawlenty visited in Cambridge as he campaigned across the state. I was really very fortunate to get a chance to talk with him for a little while. And as we were speaking, he did, too, ask me, just as we're telling you now, what were the concerns of the staff and of the council in the city of Cambridge? And as we also were speaking, and I've already quickly looked through the notes here, so hopefully I'm able to say this, Governor Pawlenty did tell me that the state would be very, very carefully looking at LGA or the eight cities, and very possibly those payments may be increased. And I did look ahead, and I see that's possible. Actually, it made me really very happy, because at this time, we are not even receiving the same amount of money per capita as we did in 2002. Our council does work very hard with staff and with our citizens to really maintain our long-range financial plan for the city. And we are committed to managing the city's resources as judiciously as possible. And actually, John will say a couple of more words about that. But please believe, I am very, very happy to be here this evening. I think it is a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to sit and speak directly to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Just for members of the audience and people up here, it is approaching 9 o'clock. We're going to continue and allow you to have an opportunity to speak. Just keep that in mind. And then we'll also try our best to have an opportunity for anybody out there to speak as well. But if you can also keep your testimony short, we appreciate that. Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Caroline Moe, and I'm the finance director for the City of Cambridge. They don't usually let CPAs out of the office, so you'll have to bear with me. The City of Cambridge has made great strides in the last several years with its finances, and I have shared some information with you on its long-range financial plan. We think long-range financial planning is really where cities need to be and are really excited about the progress we've made. Cambridge's tax rate has decreased 34% since 2002. Local government aid is a key part for us in bringing taxes down for our citizens. So the maintenance and the increase of local government aid is incredibly important for Cambridge. Our citizens, when they get a property tax bill that's similar to or lower to the prior year, are thrilled and have plenty of places where that money can go. We don't think levy limits are necessary for the City of Cambridge. We think we know how to respond to our voters and set our tax levies responsibly. And we think we've done a good job of setting our tax rates, considering our fund balance policies, staffing needs, and capital infrastructure. So we would appreciate if we did not have to be burdened with levy limits. We don't think that they're necessary. Maintenance of service levels for Cambridge has been very challenging. Our core businesses are public safety and public works. Nothing that glamorous. But the maintenance of those basic services for our citizens has been very challenging. Several years ago, we used to get a significant amount of federal aid to fund police officers through the COPS programs. Those dollars are no longer available to us, and local dollars have had to make up those differences. Health insurance. I was glad to hear Dennis Doran talk about that, because health insurance is spiraling out of control and really affecting our city's budget. Our last health insurance renewal had an increase of 44%, and that was the best of the three offers we had. It wasn't based on any claims history of unusual diseases. It wasn't based on cancer or heart claims. Our biggest claims were maternity claims. It's really hard to do something with that. So the control of health care is really important, not only for other industries, but for local governments as well. The volatility of the LGA has been incredibly difficult for us to manage as well. In the middle of our budget cycle in 2003, we lost about half of our LGA. We were able to plan and manage our way through that crisis without significantly impacting service levels. We cannot sustain those kind of cuts ever again. More LGA would help us, especially if it could come without restrictions, but we are willing to take LGA if it came with restrictions, such as for public safety. Another major challenge for us is replacement of infrastructure. The maintenance, the municipal state aid funding that we get from the state is not increasing, but our needs for infrastructure replacement are. In 2000, 42% of the roads in Cambridge were in poor condition. We were not happy with that and have taken on a very bold initiative to improve the roads in Cambridge. In the last 5 years, we've been able to cut that statistic in half. However, it's very much on the backs of our property owners through the levying a special assessment. So if we could get more funding for municipal state aid, we can put that into our infrastructure replacement, and that would be helpful. The other major problem for Cambridge, and I'm going to look at Rob, and I'm going to look at Olson, is Trunk Highway 95. It's a significant problem in Cambridge. It does not handle the traffic flow, and we need some help to fix that state highway to foster the proper economic conditions in Cambridge. I cannot echo that problem enough. That's one of our biggest problems. I appreciate your coming to this region and hearing our input this evening.
Thank you, Karen. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is John Schlegel. I'm a city council member from the city of Cambridge. Since there's still several speakers to go yet, and it's already 9 o'clock, I'll be real brief, and instead of suggesting how you might spend state money, I'll make a philosophical statement. I remember not too long ago when Governor Pawlenty was making suggestions about holding schools accountable, and he wasn't the only one. Many people running an in-state office said that same thing. He talked about having voters approve various tax issues at a local level. And I guess my philosophical statement is that I've never known anyone that enjoyed having somebody come up and say, do what I say, don't do what I do. So my philosophical statement to you is that as you go through this year in the state legislature, you look at everything you do and say, whatever I enact, whatever I vote for, what I want it apply to me at the state level. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is George Johnson. I actually represent two organizations. One is the Cambridge Isani Transportation Action Council, and I could say this, that roadways, the roadway system, particularly Highway 95, is urgent in our community, and we're dedicating ourselves to do whatever we can to address that. Personally, I didn't be willing to pay a gas tax to make it happen. I don't. Everyone in the room won't agree with that. Actually, 51 years ago, I was the first president of the Cambridge Business Development Company, and I've devoted myself to industrial and commercial development in our community for 51 years, and we have been successful. We've built a fairly very substantial industrial and commercial development base, and it is that base that's providing the employment and is providing the lion's share of the funding that is supporting our schools. Every time we get an industry in town, we're delighted because we know that that's going to help provide better education and better services to the community. The concern I have is that we recognize that. We recognize that it's the industrial and the commercial base that's paying the lion's share of the funding, and we be very careful as we look for funds to meet all these needs, that we be very careful that we don't strangle the goose that lays the golden egg.
Thank you. And you want to go down this way again? Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape.
Good evening. I represent the Isanic Township Association. You might wonder what a township is.
I know what it is.
It's a political subdivision of 6 by 6 square miles, ideally. Some are larger, some are smaller. The largest one in the state of Minnesota is White Bear Lake. The duties of the township officials are, we call ourselves a grassroots government because we do a lot of different things, just about what the citizens want us to do. We have a budget that is set in the March of each calendar year. That's set for the following year. So 2007, we'll be setting the budget for 2008. And we like to think we're always ahead of you people. But there are drawbacks to that, because we don't always figure out what Washington or St. Paul is going to do. And sometimes we get in a little trouble that way. But anyway, we have 13 townships in our county, and this past 13th of January, we had our annual township officers meeting. And we passed the following resolution at this meeting. And if I may, I'll read that to you. Whereas the local government aid was cut in 2003, whereas the cut in aid varied from 5 to 10% of the township budgets and totaled more than $200,000 for the 13 Isanic townships, whereas the cut in aid resulted in increases in property taxes to all of the townships for the following years. Therefore, be it resolved that the Minnesota legislature restore local government aid to its previous level. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Appreciate that. The staff person will come and get the mic. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Pick. Identify yourself, please.
My name is Melissa Chavis, and I actually wasn't able to speak earlier, so I appreciate you making time for me to be able to make my comments now. I'm a parent of three students in the St. Francis School District, and my issues kind of bridge both the issues that you're talking about right now, property taxes and cuts to school district funding and things like that. I'll try to be brief. We are running a special election in my school district right now in an attempt to get our elementary school building bond passed. And this is the third attempt that we've made at trying to get this passed. We currently have our students in 32 portable buildings. And one of the challenges that we face that's making this so unsurmountable, it seems, is the increases to property taxes, which are for a host of reasons, including the underfunding of our education, and also the cuts to LGA and aid to municipalities and things like that. It's really put a strain on our property owners. And so they're very resistant to shelling out that additional money to pay for a building. The need is obvious. And so, you know, you look at your schools and you look at your students and you see what's happening and you know that you can do things better and more efficiently. But we really need to get some consistent level of funding from the state so that we don't have to be spending so much time and energy and money, for that matter, to go begging to the property owners every time we need improvements to our schools. It's not an effective way, in my opinion, to spend time. It's time taken away from educating our students. And it's also, we're in the third year of a 5-year operating levy. So if we're fortunate enough to get this passed, it won't be long before we're coming back again and saying, guess what, we need more money. Consistent funding for education from a state level is really going to ease that burden, and also some reinstatement of the LGA cuts that we're experiencing will really make it that tax burden more manageable for most people. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Can you just ask one question? You said this is the third time the school district is attempting to, and it's a building project?
Yes, this is for a building bond for an elementary school, and it has failed on at least two occasions.
And how many temporary buildings, what we call craters, do you have?
32.
Okay. And down the other end, I guess. Maybe a portable mic probably would be better. Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Wayne Anderson. I also represent the Sandy County Township Association. This is a little bit different issue I'd like to bring up. One of the township officers was involved in an incident last fall. I'm not sure if it's a result, but probably was a result of the increase in crime in the area. But this official, he's a member, he still currently is a member of a township supervisor. He's been a supervisor for 37 years. He was involved in a citizen's arrest on a couple that were involved in theft at a property that he was keeping an eye on. Well, not getting into all the gory details, he was subsequently arrested and charged with a felony. And I guess, well, that's naturally has brought the community together, and with a lot of outrage. I guess what I'm asking for, and what we're asking for, is some way to address that problem of a citizen's arrest. I think it's pretty much out of line that he's being charged with a felony.
I don't have an answer for you, but thank you.
I know, thank you.
And on that particular issue, if you can correspond with your local representatives, maybe they can do some research
to help you
on that as well.
We have been.
Okay, very good. They probably are well informed, huh?
Very good. Good evening. Thanks for your time and listening to this. I have to agree with this gentleman. Rob and I had a discussion today about the same gentleman.
Let me interrupt, and if you can introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jerry Durrell. I'm a local taxpayer.
Good. We all are.
Oh, I'm sure you are. And we need to change our crime laws. They're ridiculous. This gentleman's been a law-abiding citizen for a long time in this community. I'm going to back him up 100%. And whatever we have to do as a community to back this gentleman up, to supersede this, we're going to do it, because it just seems like our laws protect the criminal, and the victims end up to being the bad guys, and I think that's wrong. It needs a major overhaul. So that's one of my issues. The second one's property taxes. With home values going down, my property taxes went back up. I haven't had a raise in probably 18 years that I see I could keep because of inflation, medical issues, cost of insurance, copays, you name it, tax increases, tax takeaways. It just needs to be revised. Everything has to be. Inflation has gone up, gas prices. Everybody's pumping money into their vehicles. Homes are being shut down, repossessed. Everything. It's just it's unfortunate. The third thing I'd like to bring up is I have to agree with Mr. Duran. Welfare in this state, I think, is out of control. I think it needs to be revised. I think there's some issues with people that are on MA that shouldn't be. I know there's people that have the winters off, and I personally know some of them. I think it's ridiculous that they get MA. And I think, I feel, that people that sign up for welfare should really be asked to go out and work and maybe pay for their daycare. I think you'd have a lot more money for education, and I think it'd be a lot better spent on education than some welfare programs. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So thank you very much, panel, and appreciate very much you coming up. Is there anybody now in the audience that would like to stand up and give us their 2 cents worth or whatever, and way in the back if you can. And we'll get the mic to you. Phyllis, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, we did have
one person, and I saw another person nodding when we were talking about the need for transportation expenses.
Sure.
And this is the biggest crowd of real people I've seen since the session started.
Well, come on, we're real people.
Since the session started in St. Paul, and I wondered if you just asked for a show of hands on people who would not object to some kind of gasoline tax, because that's our standard way of doing transportation import expenses.
So did everyone hear Representative Kahn's question?
I just like to know from the with show of hands, nobody's going to take your name down or hold you to account. Show of hands from people in the audience if part of the proposal for a solution for the transportation problems was an increase in the gas tax of, we've talked about 5 cents and 10 cents. Who would support that?
Okay.
I'm getting names.
Okay.
I said no names, but I you know, Mr. Chairman, I think some of our citizens are ahead of us in helping find solutions for some of the problems that we have.
Okay, over to the side. If you can again identify yourself for the tape.
Good evening. I'm Carol Mirnan from the Pine City School District, co-president. I just want to reiterate a couple of things that have been mentioned earlier from our district. We have concerns with lack of technology funding. We feel that because it's becoming such a global society that the funding actually has been going backwards in support of that in our school systems. Also, in our district, we have a major crisis for teachers in special education that need to have special licensures now. And with the number of people that will be retiring in our district in the near future, there is going to be a major crisis with who will be able to fulfill those vacancies. There is major cuts to human services and other adult services with disabilities. And right now there's a real large demand for increases in these services in our school district, yet funding has been cut majorly. Finally, we would really encourage the legislative leaders to please get to the schools to see the needs firsthand. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Just as a point of that, we're in the planning stage, and this is for members of the committee as well, that next Monday evening we're planning to go to an elementary school to take some testimony, and hopefully we'll be able to have some classrooms open and listen to the parents there as well. So we're going to try to do that. Thank you. Anybody else that would like to? You can't throw rotten tomatoes, but you can say things. Okay?
I got a 104-year-old story. We're talking taxes.
If you can just identify yourself for the tape.
Okay. Benzerbrook Township, I say. No, this 1903. This man by the name of Andrew Stanius was very disgusted with his taxes. $3. $3. He didn't have a car, of course, so he walked to town, paid his $3, and complained. You know what the answer was from the assessor? Don't worry, Andrew. There's more people coming. Your taxes will go way down. They'll help you pay. I have one more request from you all. Please don't spend any time at that state capitol worried about Ziggy Wolf's
stadium. Please. I always say there's a reason that Ziggy is as rich as he is. Okay, if you're going to stand up and identify yourself, please see.
Hi, I'm Mona Nastra, and you're talking about the uninsured, that they can't afford their health care. I am now on COBRA, and I am spending about $700 a month, which I thought was very fair. I have to go off of COBRA. I thought $1,000, $1,200, okay. But now I was told by Blue Cross and Blue Shield that I could guarantee myself to go back on a program. It's $24,000 a year. No wonder there's so many people that are uninsured.
Wow.
Who can afford $24,000 a year for insurance? Then also another thing was Mr. Novak mentioned something about special education and all the money that is spent there. I'm not saying to parents that have children in special ed that, but I do think some of that money could be redirected. I had a son that was in special education. When he was in elementary school, he was in special ed. He learned the things that he needed to know when he got out of school. This was wonderful. All of a sudden, mainstreaming came in. He was in middle school. He not only did not learn very much during those years in the middle school, but also because he was in classes that he was not capable of learning in, the students, the teachers had to work with him, and the students that were supposedly normal, that were supposed to be advancing in their education, were held back because the teachers had to spend more time with my son. I do not believe in all the mainstreaming that is going on. There is socializing, I realize, in school, but my son had it when he was in Fayette. He had it in choir. He had it in the lunchroom. He did not need it in the classroom where he was there to learn. Thank goodness when he got to high school that they kind of did not make him mainstream. They went and had, again, a special ed, and that the teacher helped him with the classes that he was to get in the normal. They went and geared it down to his level in a special, in his special ed room. And so thereby, he was not holding back the kids that were learning in the regular classes. Sometimes I think that there is too much of these special ed kids in the regular classrooms, and how is a normal kid supposed to learn in advance to go and rule our country in the future?
Thank you. Anybody else? Well, if not, I want to take an opportunity on behalf of every one of us up here to thank each and every one of you for coming out tonight. It's kind of a little snowy out there. It's easy to sit home at the TV and say, I don't think I'll go out tonight. But let me sincerely say from each one of us, both Republicans and Democrats that are on this particular panel, that we're going to take your suggestions to heart. We're going to view them. We're going to try our best to respond to your concerns. We have some constraints involved in our budget process. It's stated that we have a $2.1 billion deficit of that surplus. I'm sorry. I've had years of the other. But of that $2.1 billion, $1 billion of it is one-time money that someone addressed that you can't use for ongoing programs. $900 million of that would be in inflation if we had that in the budget. So it's that would take up just the normal inflation. So we're looking at the margins of about $200 million of available resources to address some of the issues that you've talked about. That doesn't mean that we're not going to try our best to prioritize those, and we're going to try our best to respond to your community needs. I want to thank each and every one of you again for coming out, and I want to thank also the local elected officials, the people that sometimes when we get into trouble, we push the trouble down to the mayors and the council people and the county commissioners and the people that run the hospitals and all those particular people that go to work every day. Thank you again very much for that. And for the members of the panel, we'll try to leave at 9:30. If you're not on the bus, you may be walking.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry.
Oh, Mr.
Okay,
Chair?
Yes, Representative East first.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just like to, on behalf of the community, thank this committee for coming and taking the time to come up here and really listen to some of the concerns that we have, and also thank you for the community. But I'd ask you to give us a round of applause.
And Senator Olson?
Yeah, I too would like to thank everyone for coming. But, you know, I heard a lot of doom and gloom tonight, but I was a 10-year North Branch school board member, so a lot of the teachers and were my colleagues when I was on that board, and I was just recently a county commissioner here, and we can get a lot of things done, and there's a feeling at the legislature that this is really kind of the year to make it happen. We built that bridge on 35 at 17 with the help of Congressman Oberstar, and now he's chair of the Transportation Committee. He's the most powerful man in the country on transportation. And if they don't take away the earmarks, we'll probably get some pretty good earmarks. So we don't call them earmarks. We call them public project. So I think that don't feel too bad because help is on the way.
And again, I've been reminded that there's cookies for anybody who wants a little snack for the evening. Thank you very much for your company. We really appreciate it. Meeting is adjourned.